accession number 29958, reel 6.
What were you being told, or what? How were you sort of developing your philosophy as a bomber pilot, a potential bomber pilot? Obviously, people hear of the bombing of places like Dresden and the extraordinary damage caused by bombers, and how are you sort of seeing your role? Here you are, you've got a cookie with a, you know, huge capacity to blow things up. You've got the incendiary bombs, and knowing what these things are going to cause, you know, thousands of feet below you.
Yes. Well, I don't think it that concerned us so much, because you see, we were told at HCU, at the conversion unit, that we would every raid that you went on could be entirely different, and that you would attend a briefing on the squadron before you went on a raid. You'd be given a your navigator would be given a separate briefing. You would be given a separate briefing, and you would be told the target they had selected for you to bomb, whether it was going to be a 1,000 bomber raid, part of a 1,000 bomber raid, and to be very exercise caution, especially at night time. And the important thing was to realise that when you were in an aircraft stream going to a target, that as long as you felt some regular judders, that in other words you were in the slipstream of other aircraft, you could feel fairly comfortable, because you knew you had friends around you, and then they would tell you whether the course and where you could expect to get ACAC fire, where there might be fighters that could attack you, and generally speaking, you were briefed on these things. So you had, until you got to the squadron, you didn't really know what you were in for, and of course that was to happen fairly soon after your conversion onto the Halifax, and it was I'm just trying to. By the way, just before I was posted to Ruffath, I was commissioned as a pilot officer, received my commission. Unfortunately, all my crew were all non-commissioned officers, which meant that I was separated into an officer's mess, and they would be in the sergeant's mess. And so I didn't see, apart from flying with them, and on leave, I wouldn't see a great deal of them. So having received my commission and having received my crew, we then went on leave, and as a matter of fact, one of my crew, Laurie Goodburn, asked myself and another member of the crew, Australian member of the crew, to come up to his family at Barnsley in Yorkshire, and where we met the family and spent some very, very pleasant few days leave. And now, Mr. Goodburn Sr. was quite a character. He was an avid gambler on the horse racing, and was an avid Barnsley supporter in the soccer competition. And he knew all the names of the champion jockeys and had all the hot tips of what was going to win at the races. Even that, I was surprised that they even had races during the wartime, but of course that was good for the morale of the population. But this was quite interesting, because we made several visits over the period of the next few months to when we were on leave to Barnsley, which was a coal mining town in Yorkshire. On leave, at one stage we went down to Kent to my rear gunner's family in Kent, and it was quite interesting meeting or travelling to different parts of England, especially going from Yorkshire to Kent, which was most probably only something like 150 miles, but it was enjoyable to visit these various places and meet the families of my crew members. Well,
what was it like to crew up and meeting these different people, getting yourselves together?
Yes, well, unfortunately, you had no choice about your crew. You were allocated crew members. You couldn't sort of select them, and not that that made any difference, but it was.
I have heard of people sort of wandering around the mess and saying, "Oh, I need a bomber. How about you?" sort of thing, or "Would you like to crew with me?" Some people were given that luxury.
Well, it certainly didn't happen to us, but if they did, well, that was. But I think it's quite good to have a crew allocated. Then there can't be any bad feelings between. Pilots. I mean, pilots might say, "Well, you know, you got this fella that I wanted," and all this sort of stuff. So, as far as I'm concerned, I think it was a far better idea the way it happened to me. But no doubt, it did happen where people, and possibly in specialised crews like the Pathfinders, where they were Pathfinder crews were. Very, very specially trained, because they flew and they were usually about 1,000 feet above the target, circling for the whole period of whether it be a 1,000 bomber raid or whatever. And there was a master bomber and there were pathfinders, and they were dropping flares on the target. And so those sort of crews had to have very special people, especially a top line navigator and good gunners to keep them protected, and a very good pilot. So I can imagine that in those cases then you would be able to select your crew from and find out the experience that these people had, and so I can understand that. But it's as I said before, I think it's far better if you are allocated a crew, and then there's no recriminations. You can't get one pilot saying, criticising for stealing the fellow that who had agreed to come to him, and all that sort of.
So here you are in Halifax. What was it like? What's it actually like to fly Halifax?
Well, it was Halifax being a very heavy aircraft, and they're approximately the same size, the Lancasters and the Halifaxes. They were after flying a single engine, although Tiger Moths are not very fast, so you don't have any problem there. But with Airspeed Oxfords, they fly at quite a decent speed, and so you've got heavy bombers are reasonably cumbersome, and they take especially with a bomb load, they take a bit of getting off the deck, as they say, off the runway. When you've got a full bomb load, and your takeoff speed would be something around about 90 miles per hour, and you would climb at possibly slightly higher speed than that, and then you'd cruise at somewhere around about 120 miles an hour, which compared with aircraft of today, of course, is just almost slow to stop. But so they were not easy to get off the ground with a fully laden bomb load, but when they were empty, they were quite easily to get off the ground. But you had trims, trims which were you can set to turn to help with the weight of taking the weight off the controls, so that it was easier for you to control them. But when it came to doing corkscrews or evasive tactics, they were fairly heavy aircraft, especially if you had your full bomb load. to manoeuvre to do to a proper corkscrew in this type of aircraft. But
that must have been a bit of a concern for you if you thought that you might have a fast flying Fokker or ME-109 up your tail.
That's right. Yes. Well, fortunately, we had all crew members apart from the wireless operator and the navigator were always looking out for fighter aircraft. So you had a fairly early warning, you hoped, if your crew were on the job, warning you about them. But of course, I imagine that if you had a fighter on your tail, you'd be working as hard as you could to get to look after your plane and your crew and to get them out of the fix. But the problem is that when you're flying at a certain height and you have to fly at a certain height when you're bombing, because all aircraft are at different stages and at different heights during the bombing attack, if you do dive, you've got to get back onto your allocated flight level before you get to your target, and to have a run to your target, you need it. You've got to be flying fairly straight and level if you want an accurate result from when your bombs are released.
In relation to the crew, how did they operate? Presumably, it's a good crew is a well-oiled machine in itself, inside a hopefully well-oiled aircraft.
Yes. Well, of course, crew. When you think about it, crew members were just like yourself. They wanted to survive, and the only way to survive is to be very, very alert and keen and conscientious. And I think that's what all young people at that stage, they certainly learned how to give of their best and work hard and their eyesight improved radically. When your life's at danger, your eyesight can improve radically, and you can search. In fact, all members of the crew, apart from the other two I mentioned, would be searching the sky. And the pilot, and as a pilot, you would always search 180 degrees at all times. You just automatically did that, so it was most important that your crew were dedicated, as naturally they would be, because they didn't, obviously they wanted to live longer than they wanted to see the war through and get through the just the same as you did. They were just normal human beings.
Let's talk then about your first experience of operational flying. What was it like? What were you being told? What were the briefings associated with?
Well, the first raid was the first flight, actually, the first flight that we operational flight we went on was a diversionary flight to the east of France, to the eastern France, and I think this was to get you accustomed to the get you ready for a really important operation. And it was also to drop tinsel, which was almost like a aluminium strips. You drop tinsel to let the radar on the ground think that there were hundreds of aircraft instead of just one or two aircraft, because we did this as a small number of aircraft operations, so that when you did that, you'd use the tinsel to upset the radar and think that you had a large operation instead of only a few aircraft.
I would have thought that a diversionary operation was actually quite a major one another operation somewhere else.
Well, that's right, because they obviously wanted the people in southern Germany to think that the raid was coming from the south instead of from maybe the west, or from the northwest, or from the in that area, so that the real raids were taking place elsewhere, and that's the idea of the diversionary raids. And that was just to get us used to, in case we came across fighters, which we didn't do. We copped a bit of flak, but flying at around 18,000 to 20,000 feet, you could do a bit of weaving, gentle weaving, when flak was coming up at you. But fortunately, it was quite away from you, maybe 100 yards or 50 yards away from you, so that we didn't receive any direct hit on that particular operation.
But what was the thought? Okay, this is our first flight in operation. Yeah. You know, what was going through your mind as you took off?
Well, I think you just concentrate on doing your job. In other words, getting the aircraft at the speed you're supposed to be flying, up to the height. Often you would only fly at say 12 or 14,000 feet for a certain limited time, and then you were then your briefing was to climb the aircraft to 18,000 feet or 19,000 feet or wherever wherever the level was. But your briefing, you had a map of the track that you were to follow. Your navigator, of course, had it, because he had to get you there and get you back, and so that was the important thing you thought about, was just doing the job that you were supposed to do according to the briefing, and that's the way it went. But the next raid was on we were briefed to do a raid on the Dortmund Ems Canal, because
before we do that, what was it like to receive flak for the first time, to be flying into potential danger?
Well, of course you were worried and concerned, but I think that made you more alert, and to the idea that you had to, even though you had a course to fly on, that you flew, you did some slight weaving to keep out of the way of the flak, and so that they had to change their sights they were only really flying with the, if you didn't have a searchlight coning you, the ACAC didn't have a great chance of, it was almost hit and miss. It was based purely on the radar, and if you were dropping
people talk of window and
window, that's right. If you're dropping this window from the aircraft, which was a metallic thing, they wouldn't know which was an aircraft and which was a piece of metallic
tinsel.
That's right. And so that was it. So you felt reasonably safe, although you were worried and obviously concerned. Otherwise, because that gave you a little bit of adrenaline to make sure that you did the job as you were instructed and as you should do it.
In your experience, were airmen superstitious?
Well, I wasn't, but I believe some. I've heard of some people who carried a rabbit's foot and some chain around their neck. Well, of course, we always had our dog tags, of course, around us, our identification tags, our two metal tags around our neck. But we always. But I was not suspicious at all, but I'm sure there were plenty of people who were, and if they left their token behind that brought them luck, then I felt sorry for them, because possibly if they got through, then they'd realised that it wasn't so important after all. But of course, if they'd copped it, if they were shot down, well, all you can do is feel sorry for them sad for them and their families. But
in relation to being shot down, what were you being told if you were taken prisoner?
Oh, well, of course, you could only give your rank, your name, your rank, and your serial number. That's the only three things you could divulge. And of course, you as you flew normally in a battle jacket top, and you carried a revolver with you, you had that as some nebulous form of protection if you happened to parachute and land in the enemy territory. But fortunately, that didn't happen to me, so I didn't. I was fortunate in that area. But my first large raid that I was involved on, was my second trip, was we were briefed to demolish barges on the Dortmund-Ems Canal in the Ruhr, because the large factories there were turning out ammunition and all sorts of war machines. They could be tanks and maybe even aircraft, and so that we were briefed to bomb these particular barges in the Dortmund-Ems Canal. And so that wasn't a large raid. By the way, these raids usually were anything from maybe 7 hours to about 9 hours in length. The range of the Halifax bomber was not as that's the other adverse feature of them compared with the glamorous aircraft. They had a range of they could bomb east of Berlin, whereas we couldn't quite get to Berlin, and so those raids that to Berlin and beyond usually were about a 9 to 11 hour trip, and so that most of our raids were no more. This particular raid, I think it was only about 7 hours, and
still trying sort of experience, I would assume. It's a long time being in the air over enemy territory, for instance.
Well, it is, of course. The thing about it is that you were you were very keen to bomb the target accurately, because in the bomb bay of the aircraft was a camera which automatically, when the bombs were released, it took a photograph of the target area, and so that when you got back to base and those films were developed, they could tell exactly, they could plot, the boffins could plot exactly where your bombs would have landed at the time of release over the target. So that was another thing to keep you working hard and honest, to make sure that you didn't drop your bombs at anywhere along the track and then shoot for home.
Well, people talk of knowing of bombers that didn't quite make it to the target and hightailed it out of there.
Yes, yes, I believe that I've heard of that as well, and I've no doubt that could happen. And it depends on the cases, of course. It may be that the aircraft was damaged, badly damaged, and to get back to base, to have any chance of getting back to base, you would have to jettison your bombs and maybe fly a more direct course home, although it's very dangerous to fly other than on the path that was allocated to the raid, because you don't know what fighters there might be around, or what the flak in those particular areas that you would fly over that was not on the track, whereas we were briefed as to where we should expect the major areas of flak and or fighter intervention. So I can imagine that there could be the odd case of where somebody, through maybe nervous tension and fear, could have done that. But I like to think more of the fact that the people whose aircraft was in serious trouble would be the ones that would possibly release their bombs before they should have. The other thing, of course, is that then you had to live with your conscience, not knowing where the bombs landed. Whereas where you're given a target, where you're told to bomb a certain target, then that's what you do. And if you drop your bombs anywhere else, you could endanger civilian life and not do any good.